Some might argue that America is going through an identity crisis. I would suggest we're going through an integrity crisis. Integrity is a hot issue today. In a society where we feel like we can't trust anyone anymore, integrity is a big deal. And when we talk about integrity, I'm not talking about someone's reputation. Reputation is what people think about you. Your character is who you really are. Somebody has once said that character is who you are when nobody's looking. And that's when you find out if integrity is for real. Integrity is about a person's trustworthiness. The word itself means to be whole or complete. It means that what you say and what you mean are the same thing. It means that when you say you do something, that's exactly what you plan to do. When you make a promise, you intend to keep it. One reason why integrity is such a premium in our culture today is that it's so easy to excuse our lack of it. I always love the line the late Dr. Howard Hendricks said, "If you want to do something, you'll find a way. If you don't, you'll find an excuse." And boy, we are really good at making excuses, aren't we? Someone else said, you find someone that's good at making excuses, they're probably good at little else. Yeah, that's true too. And we find all kinds of excuses for our lack of integrity. You see that a lot in politics, don't you? It's hard to find people of integrity in leadership because the temptation is so great to not live up to our word. And when you hear the phrase, everybody's doing it, you're not too far from the truth. Now, over the last few weeks, we've been looking at the book of Daniel. My guess is that if you were to ask people who were in any way familiar with the Bible at all to do a word identification and you said the word Daniel, most people would come back with the lion's den, right? I mean, that's the story many of us have heard from Sunday school. We learned about Daniel in the lion's den. It's undoubtedly the best known incident in his life. I would suggest a more fitting word association with Daniel, and that's the word integrity. When you go throughout the book of Daniel, you are going to see he's a man of integrity. Not sinlessness. I'm not saying he's perfect. There's a difference between perfection and integrity. Let me give you a just brief example. In 1962... there was an invasion of the island of Cuba that the United States government backed, and it was an absolute failure. And the president of the United States at that time got on television and said, "This was an embarrassing failure, and I take full responsibility, and we are going to clean up this mess." His approval rating went up. About a decade later, there was another much less significant event that took place that may or may not have had the administration's backing, but the president came out and said, "I don't know anything about this. I had nothing to do with this." And it eventually drove him from office. His approval rating went down. Whether or not he was guilty didn't seem to matter. Integrity steps up and says, "I blew it. I take responsibility for it. I'm going to do what I can about it." A lack of integrity seeks to shift blame onto somebody else or make excuses or avoid responsibility whatsoever. Daniel was a man of integrity. And it was his integrity that gets him into the biggest dilemma in his life. So we're going to look at Daniel chapter 6, the story of Daniel in the lion's den. In many ways, it's familiar with the story we looked at last week, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. In both cases, the people of God are confronted with a choice. And if they choose to uphold their integrity, they're facing a very horrible way to die. But I think there's a lot of lessons we can learn here about integrity. In fact, when the heat is on, we need consistent application of our obedience. And that's what Daniel shows us in this chapter. Now, before we get into chapter 6, I want to direct your attention to the end of chapter 5. At the end of Daniel chapter 5, verse 30 says, "That very night Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. This marks the end of the Babylonian Empire, which to this point in history was the greatest on earth. And now we see the rise of what historians call the Medo-Persian Empire, or sometimes simply the Persian Empire, which would eclipse Babylon and be even greater. It would stretch all the way from Libya and Egypt to the west, all the way to the Indus River on the east. It was the largest empire known to history at that time. Now, we're told that Darius the Mede takes over, and that identification's challenged scholars. He is not Darius the First, who ruled Persia from 522 to 486 BC. This is like a generation before that. He does appear in Scripture, particularly in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, but it's not the same man. There's three possible identifications made to this Darius. Some have thought maybe this is Cyrus the Great. And Darius the Mede was his throne name for the first year of his reign. That might sound really weird to us, but it was a very common practice in the ancient world. And we're going to see later on, the end of chapter 6 kind of hints to maybe that's the case. Others have thought maybe this was Cyrus' son, Cambyses II. Problem with that is we do know that Cyrus reigned later, so the sequence doesn't work at all. Some others point to a man named Gubaro, who was the governor of Babylon during the reigns of Cyrus and Cambyses. We really don't know. Honestly, I think the best explanation is this is probably Cyrus the Great during his first year of his reign, because he was trying to bring together the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians, he may have used Darius as his throne name. At any rate, there's a regime change. We have a new emperor, we have a new empire. And I'm sure Daniel at this point is wondering, what's next? Daniel at this point is an old man. He's probably in his 80s. He's been away from home for 65 years, serving in the Babylonian Empire in their government. Now a new government takes over. Oftentimes, when a new administration comes in, they clean house. If you worked for the former leader, you're out. Bring in new. Maybe Daniel was thinking he was going to retire, take it easy. But that wasn't going to be the case. So we get into Daniel 6, where we see a spotless reputation that leads to a despicable plot. Look at verse 1. "It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. One scholar says, Daniel 6 opens with a miracle, a squeaky clean politician. That would be considered a miracle in our day, wouldn't it? Now, what Darius does, because he has such a vast empire to govern, is he breaks it up into provinces, kind of like our states, and appoints what we might think of as governors for each one. But Darius is smart. He knows that there's a lure, that old saying, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. He knew that when people get into positions of authority, they often use that for their own financial gain. And so he sets up these three, what we might call vice presidents, who are overseeing the 120 governors to make sure they weren't ripping off the empire. And one of those three was Daniel. Here is a man coming into power, sees Daniel, reads his resume, and says, wow, this guy's got impeccable character. What a track record. I want this guy on my team. I want him overseeing these other clowns that might be ripping me off. And apparently Darius had good reason to fear that, because all of the other governors and the other two, the vice presidents, wanted to get rid of Daniel. Why would they want to do that? Because they wanted to rip off the empire. They wanted to cheat. They wanted to get money for themselves. And Daniel's in the way because he's so clean. He's got such honesty. And that really irritated them. You know, honest politicians really irritate the other ones. And so they decide to, let's get rid of Daniel. Let's come up with something. Let's find some excuse to get rid of him. And they can't. They dig through all the records. They look through all the past. They check out his Facebook and his YouTube videos and, you know, Instagram and all that stuff for some, you know, some damning evidence, and it ain't there. They can't find anything on which to make an accusation. Now, isn't that something? I mean, how many of us could withstand that kind of investigation? We all have skeletons in our closet. Well, he didn't. Not when it came to his government service. And so in verse 5, finally, these men said, we will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God. His public service record is clean. So we got to come up with something, and the only thing we can think of is his integrity with his God. And so that's what they do. Verse 6. So the administrators and the satraps went as a group, kind of underline that phrase in your mind, to the king and said, O King Darius, live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed, not quite, that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, O king, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. So King Darius put the decree in writing. They were very clever in this plot. and the way they presented it. I'm sure they knew that Darius, being new to the throne, wanted to unify his people. Remember last week we talked about the great image that Nebuchadnezzar set up, and he wanted everybody to worship it. Probably one of the political reasons for that was for unity. And you know, if you want to really get the attention of a politician or a political leader, talk about unity, right? Party unity or you know, unity of the nation. Yeah, that's a buzzword. And so they use that. Oh, king, let's bring all these foreign people together, and so they can only pray to you for a month. That also appeals to his pride, right? Right, come on. You don't get to be king of an empire without an ego. And I'm sure that it pumped him up a little bit to think, ooh, got the whole empire. Not only am I their king, I'm their God. They have to pray to me for a month. And so he signed the decree. The reason why that was important was in those days, they had a saying about the laws of the Medes and the Persians. You could not repeal it. Even the king himself could not repeal his own signature once he signed a bill. And they knew that. And they were going to use it against him, as we're going to see. Now, remember I said in verse 6 that phrase, as a group, keep that underlined. The Hebrew here appears three times in this story. Literally, it means to rage together. And it came to be known as conspire. What we have here is a conspiracy. Now, that's another hot topic these days. We even have a group of people we call conspiracy theorists. And I'll admit, some of the conspiracies that are put forth are a little bit off the wall, but I'm sure some of them have got some truth to them. Because when people get desperate, they will work together and they will stop at nothing to accomplish their goal. We've seen that in our own day and age, and we will continue to see that until the Lord comes back. And that's what's happening here. These guys conspired together to sell Daniel right up the river. And we're going to see it throughout this chapter. So, a law is signed. Anybody that prays to anybody but the king for the next 30 days gets tossed into the lion's den. A gory way to die. What is Daniel going to do? We see that a steady reputation leads to a deadly peril. Verse 10, now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God just as he had done before. That's Daniel's response. He was going to continue doing what he had always done. Now you might wonder, why was he praying toward Jerusalem? We aren't told here, but my guess is Daniel knew the scriptures well enough. In 1 Kings 8, beginning in verse 46, Solomon is praying to the Lord. And in those verses, it says, when Israel is captive in a foreign land, they are to pray toward their homeland, toward the city which the Lord had chosen, Jerusalem. So I think he was doing this in fulfillment of Scripture. But what really amazes me here is not that he prayed towards Jerusalem. It's that he prayed at all, and that he did it so publicly. It says he went home and opened the windows. I mean, I would have at least been tempted to close the windows and draw the shades, right? You know, prayer's just between me and God. Nobody else has to know. See how easy it is to make an excuse? Come up with some little way. Hey, God, I'm sure you're going to be here next month, so, you know, I'm going to take a little hiatus if that's all right with you. surely I would be able to do more as Darius's executive vice president if I'm alive rather than lion bait. If we want to do something, we'll find a way. If we don't, we'll find an excuse. And there were a lot of excuses Daniel could have given. I'm too busy to pray. When you're that busy, you're too busy not to pray. I got to separate church and state here. Give me a break. Daniel openly defied that law in order to obey a higher law. Just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who said, I'm not going to bow to your idol, Daniel said, I am going to bow to my God. And I don't care what you threaten me with. Daniel wasn't about to become a secret agent saint. He wasn't an undercover Christian, we would say today. He was very open in his obedience. And he knew that people were watching. He knew he had been framed. This was a setup job. And he steadily repeated his practice of prayer. What about us? What would we have done in Daniel's position? Would we be faithful to prayer, even if it came with a death penalty? I find it amazing how many Christians today are clamoring, bring back prayer in schools. How about bring back prayer in church? How about that one? How about bring back prayer at home? We sing Sweet Hour of Prayer, Sweet Hour of Prayer. The average Christian spends 38 seconds in prayer every week. We love to talk about prayer, but how much of us actually do it? And as I said last Sunday night, why is it that prayer meeting, is the least attended service of the church week, regardless of denomination or independent status? Across the board, if a church still has a prayer meeting, which many of them no longer have it anymore, it is the least attended service of the week. Why? Do we not believe in prayer? Or are we just too busy? Daniel wasn't too busy to pray. He had every reason in the world not to pray, and he did anyway. We have every reason in the world to pray, and we don't, let's face it. Daniel shames us. And I say us. I don't pray nearly as much as I should. I certainly don't pray as much as Daniel did. What are we going to do about it? Well, let's get back to the story. That's too convicting. Verse 11, these men went as a group, here's the conspiracy again, and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king, and they spoke to him about his royal decree. Did you not publish a decree that says that anybody that prays to anybody but you gets thrown in the lion's den? Yeah, I think I remember signing that. He said, well, Daniel, he is praying to his God. And at that point, the king knows that he's fallen into a trap. An amazing thing happens in the heart of Darius. Look at verse 14. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Darius recognized Daniel's integrity. And just from a purely political point of view, he needed Daniel. He needed an honest man to keep everybody else in line. But I also think that he had a personal liking to Daniel. I think he just liked him. And now, through his own actions, Daniel is about to be tossed into a den of ravenous lions. Verse 16, once he realized he can't save Daniel, he says to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." I can't do it. I'm hoping your God can. Right to the very end, Darius is on Daniel's side. But I want you to notice it did not keep Daniel out of the lion's den. That's another one of the lessons we learn here. Now, remember, Daniel isn't in the lion's den because of something he did wrong. It's because of what he did right. And notice verse 17. Wow. This is just amazing. A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of the nobles so that Daniel's situation could not be changed. Does that sound a little bit familiar? Rolling a stone over the opening to keep someone inside, sealed. Just like Jesus, wasn't it? And the comparisons here are pretty astounding. But this is no joke. This is a situation that very easily could have ended Daniel's life. And Daniel was faced with a question. And it's a question that believers down through the years have been faced with. What matters most, my worshiping God or my safety? Now, psychologists will tell you that self-preservation is the highest motivation a human being has. We'll do anything to protect ourselves. We'll do anything to try to save ourselves. And there are times when, like Daniel, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, like the early Christians, we're going to be faced with a question: what's more important, your God or your personal safety? What's our answer going to be? See, Daniel at this point was confronted with the temptation of making his own personal safety his idol. I'm going to put that ahead of God. You say, well, that kind of stuff doesn't happen today. Really? How about for 16-year-old Cassie Bernal in Columbine High School, who had a shotgun put to her face and said, "Do you believe in God?" She said, "Yes." And he pulled the trigger. You say, well, he was going to anyway. Maybe. She didn't know that. And you want to know the most amazing part of that story? She had been a Christian 3 months. And she said yes. What about us? Are we going to stand up for our faith even at the cost of our own personal safety? Or are we hanging on to this life with such white knuckles that I'm going to do anything to preserve my life? Really? Jesus said those who try to save their life are going to lose it. Those who lose their life for my sake will find it. That's what Daniel knew. That's what Daniel challenges us as well. As martyred missionary Jim Elliot wrote before his life was taken, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." And the truth is, you see this all throughout history, and it's going to increase as we get close to the end. Paul wrote in 2 Timothy 3:12, "Everyone who wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. Do you see any exceptions in that phrase? I don't. He wrote about himself in 2 Corinthians 1:9. Indeed, in our hearts, we felt the sentence of death. Just like Daniel. Just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Just like countless believers down through the ages. But then he said, this happened that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. What's Paul saying there? So what if they kill me? I serve a God that raises the dead. To live is Christ, to die is gain. When those choices come, what are we going to say? The question is not if the heat is on, it's when the heat is on. Jesus did not say if you have persecution, he said when you have persecution. It's going to happen. What are we going to do? Daniel chose God. Daniel chose to uphold his integrity. And that brings us to the conclusion of the story, which I'm sure you already know. But a supernatural rescue leads to a divine praise. You know, we tend to highlight Daniel as the main emphasis, but in this story, it's really more about Darius. We had seen how he tried to circumvent having Daniel put in the lion's den. When that didn't work, he's hoping that God, that Daniel's God can save him. Now look at verse 18. We find out what happened to Daniel through Darius' eyes. Actually, it's verse 19. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called out to Daniel in an anguished voice, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? We read earlier that Darius was up all night. He couldn't sleep. He couldn't eat. He was so worried about Daniel. Kind of funny, isn't it? Daniel's in the lion's den, but we're talking about how bad a night the king had. But he comes out to the entrance of the lion's den, and he's saying, Daniel, are you there? And Daniel answered, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done any wrong before you, O king. The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God. Just like the three men, didn't even smell like smoke. Daniel got out of there without a scratch. He wasn't down there fighting off the lions. The lions didn't lay a paw on him. Not one fang. Not one scratch. Daniel was vindicated. He was pulled out of the lion's den. And then verse 24, at the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den along with their wives and children. We think that's horribly unfair, but it was very common in the ancient world. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. There were actually biblical critics who said, well, this wasn't really a miracle because the lions weren't hungry. I think that verse kind of takes care of that criticism. But I want to focus a little bit on Darius again. I think this is an important lesson we need to learn. Darius really liked and respected Daniel. He had appointed him to a high position and was about to appoint him to the highest position below himself. I mean, can you imagine having a vice president of the United States that was fully committed to God and serving Jesus Christ? Seems almost unreal. And I'm not trying to say that Darius was a believer, but he really liked Daniel. And when he found out Daniel's fate, he did everything he could to try to protect him and save him. And he couldn't. And I think the lesson here is, when you find people in leadership, maybe they are believers, maybe they're not, but they may be favorably disposed towards Christians and towards what we want, there's a limit to their power. That's why Psalm 146:3 says, "Do not put your trust in princes, in mortal men who cannot save. They might like you all the way to the lion's den." So let's be careful in whom we trust. It's in God we trust, not in anybody else. Another lesson is that people who have integrity refuse to make excuses. There are lions all around us. 1 Peter 5:8 says, Satan roams about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. The lions are there, and they're real. We can't shut their mouths, but God can. So as we wrap this up, when the heat is on, when our faith is under fire, we need creative alternatives. Sometimes we just need to think about other options that'll allow us to continue to obey God. We need calm assertiveness. There comes a time and a place where we stand up and say, our God can deal with this, and yet maintain a calm attitude. We need courageous affirmation. We need to have the guts of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that says, our God can rescue us from your fiery furnace, but even if he doesn't, we're not going to bow. And we need consistent application of our obedience. Regardless of the cost, are we going to obey God? That's the challenge. That's really the challenge of the whole book of Daniel. It's a challenge I hope we can take with us and put it into practice in our lives.